Good evening. I've been given a passage to talk about this evening, and the title, as you know, if you've been here several weeks, we've been looking at different meals in the Bible, and tonight I've got the one that meals that heal. I like what you're doing there, John. Very good. The English teacher in me loves that rhyme in that. Very good. So anyway, it's from John, and it's chapter 21. So if you've got a Bible with you in any formal electronic device, or say a paper one, get in front of you, John 21. I'm not going to read the whole passage, but I'm going to read a significant bit of it. So starting at verse 1, John 21. Later, Jesus appeared again to the disciples beside the Sea of Galilee, and this is how it happened. Several of the disciples were there: Simon Peter, Thomas, nicknamed the Twin, Nathanael from Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two other disciples. Simon Peter said, "I'm going fishing." "We'll come too," they all said. So they went out in the boat, but they caught nothing all night. At dawn, Jesus was standing on the beach, but the disciples couldn't see who he was. He called out, "Fellows, have you caught any fish?" "No," they replied. Then he said, "Throw out your net on the right-hand side of the boat, and you'll get some." So they did, and they couldn't haul in the net because there were so many fish in it. Then the disciple Jesus loved said to Peter, "It's the Lord." When Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his tunic, for he had stripped for work, jumped into the water and headed to shore. The others stayed with the boat and pulled the loaded net to the shore, for they were only about 100 yards from shore. When they got there, they found breakfast waiting for them, fish cooking over a charcoal fire and some bread. "Bring some of the fish you've just caught," Jesus said. So Simon Peter went aboard and dragged the net to the shore. There were 153 large fish, and yet the net hadn't torn. "Now come and have some breakfast," Jesus said. None of the disciples dared to ask him, "Who are you?" They knew it was the Lord. Then Jesus served them the bread and the fish. This was the third time Jesus had appeared to his disciples since he'd been raised from the dead. After breakfast, Jesus asked Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" "Yes, Lord," Peter replied. "You know I love you." "Then feed my lambs," Jesus told him. Jesus repeated the question, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" "Yes, Lord," Peter said. "You know I love you." "Then take care of my sheep," Jesus said. A third time he asked him, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Peter was hurt that Jesus asked the question a third time. He said, "Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you." Jesus said, "Then feed my sheep." I'm going to end there, but do read the rest of that passage when you get a chance. As you know, the context of this is that it's after Jesus has risen from the dead, and there are various stories in the Gospels of Jesus appearing to various people, and it's one of these occurrences. And I think there is a sort of irony that John's given me the breakfast meal, because those of you that know me would know that if Jesus turned up for breakfast, I'd go, "Can you come back for lunch?" Because if it's a choice between getting out of bed 10 minutes early for breakfast or staying in bed for 10 more minutes, I'll definitely be under my duvet. So actually, I think it's probably quite apt that I was given the breakfast story to look at again. I think probably definitely there's a way of God prompting me here, if not just a sort of humour about it. And I guess this is a very famous story. I certainly remember it as a child coming to church. What was interesting when I reflected on it is the only bit I remembered, actually, from those Sunday school days was the bit about the net being cast over again onto the other side and it coming back with a lot more fish. I didn't remember the bit after it, which is perhaps the most important bit of this story, the bit where Jesus says three times, "Do you love me?" And yet I don't remember that bit. So I felt, as I was looking at this, there was something fresh for me in this story, and I sort of hope that through sharing that with you tonight, there might therefore be something fresh for you as well. So I think there are just four things that I wanted to draw out of this passage this evening. And the first one is that this meal and this encounter really reminds us of the reality of God. They'd been fishing all night. They must have been tired, despondent, feeling really down on their luck. And Jesus comes along and says, "You know, go back, cast your net on the other side of the boat," and suddenly there's all this fish. And I guess they could have said, oh, well, that was a coincidence. We might say, oh, that was a coincidence, and try and dismiss it, except that, you know, they'd been there all night. This was not a coincidence. It was something that Jesus was doing as a symbol, if you like, that he wants to have power in earthly things, in our lives. And it got me thinking, you know, do we actually really understand the reality of God? That God isn't a distant being. That the reality of God is that he isn't the God of coincidence. When things happen, that is God. It's not coincidence. And I thought, actually, how often do we dismiss things as coincidences when maybe we ought to actually be looking at them as signs of God in our lives or in our world? How often do we dismiss acts when actually we ought to be thinking that's God trying to tell us that he's here? And yet we say, oh, just a coincidence. An example, those of you who have anything to do with secondary school teachers will know the general horror that descends around the end of May as students in Year 11 start talking about muck-up day. I feel, I'm really sorry if you're American, we only have America to blame for it. When I was at school, there was no such thing as muck-up day. We didn't do such a thing. We just signed shirts, signed books, and it was a very nice day. And if we were lucky, we got a barbecue. Not now. Now, Year 11, and it's worse because Year 12 go off on study leave, as do Year 13, and we woke up to the fact that perhaps this year we just have it all on one day and get it out of the way all on one day. But some schools still have a separate day for each one, so it's 3 days of worry and hell. And what happens is, fairly early on, they start trying to think of things they could do to muck up the school. And, you know, it always, you hear lots of rumours and, you know, it often is around fish in roof cavities and chickens. This year there was some talk that they were going to put a cow in the sixth form common room. That didn't happen, although I would have been quite entertained if that had happened. So all of this, you know, riles around and we thought that we know it happens every year. And actually, you know, generally at the school I'm at, Touchwood, we actually have a nice day. We don't tend to have too much trouble. But this year we'd had a couple of weeks with some not very nice incidents at school, not involving our students, but involving some threatening behaviour from some people outside, which had involved them coming that last week into our school grounds and threatening to punch our head teacher and swearing at him, and had resulted in us having to contact the police. And we'd heard on the grapevine the day before muck-up day that these people were planning to come back on muck-up day, knowing that they thought everybody else would be doing things so they could get away with it, to come and cause some significant damage, both to staff cars, to school windows, and various other things. And so myself and the other deputy head and the head got together and had a discussion about what we should do about this and put a few plans in place, involving, obviously, calling the police. But we had not a lot of choice, really. We just had to ride with it. And on the way to school that morning, as I drove to school, I just prayed and I said, God, you know, let today be a safe day. Let today be a day that has no trouble, no trauma. And I said, actually, God, more than that, can it actually just be a really good day? And those of you that know me will know that this year has been quite a stressful year for me at school. And I don't often come home from school going, yeah, that was a really good day. Anyway, got to school. The day passed. There was no trouble. Year 11s particularly were amazing in their behaviour. We had a cunning coincidence, but not a coincidence, I will explain in a minute, that a lot of them were in exam first thing, which gave us a sneaky opportunity to have a look in their bags for anything they might have bought they shouldn't have bought. And then we just felt guilt because in all their bags they were full of presents for teachers, chocolates, cards, all of those sorts of things. We had a barbecue with them. They were lovely. They were polite. And we didn't have a single bit of trouble from any of the students all day. The sun shone, and we got to the end of the day, and we said, what a brilliant day we've had. It was a really nice atmosphere, much better than any other year we've ever had. It got to just before 3 o'clock when our bell goes, and we dismissed Year 11 from the field. And the deputy head said to me, that's been a really good day. He sort of used the exact words that I'd used in my prayer. And I said, oh, yeah, it has been a really good day, hasn't it? And he said, well, of course, it was because we'd contacted the police and we had all our staff out and we'd spoken to the students. And he listed all these sort of earthly things we'd done to make it happen. And I just sort of gutlessly said, oh, yes, it must have been all that preparation. And at that moment, as the bell went, the sun went and the clouds clouded over. Because, again, something else we worried about was, what if it rains and we've planned this barbecue? And it was as if God was saying, no, Catherine, this wasn't a coincidence. The sunshine, the good behaviour, the trouble being kept away wasn't a coincidence. It was me in your day today. And it was as if, you know, I was easy to dismiss it, standing with my friend who's a non-Christian. I didn't take the opportunity at that point to say, actually, I prayed this morning that today was going to be a good day, and that is exactly what it's been. But actually, God was saying to me, don't dismiss today as coincidence. I was in it. You know, another one, again, if you're in education at the moment, you know that recruiting teachers is really hard. Government aren't talking about it, but it is really hard. And we needed a geography teacher for September. Usually you can recruit geography very easily. Nobody. We didn't have any applicants, not one. And then we also, to top it off, needed business studies, but only about 9 lessons a fortnight. And that's, business studies is also really hard to recruit. And 9 lessons a fortnight, that's not really enough to get anybody in for. So we've got a bit of a problem. And then, out of nowhere, I had just said, oh, we've got someone coming in tomorrow. He says he's interested in geography. Oh, brilliant. Comes in. Oh, he's great. Yeah, we'll give him a geography post. That's fantastic. Does he teach anything else on his CV? Business studies. Again, coincidence, except that I know that I've been in teaching 17 years, and people with business studies on a CV don't come to you very often, let alone with a combination of a humanities such as geography. How many times do we dismiss those little things as coincidences? The disciples could have dismissed throwing the net on the other side of the boat and the fish being there as a coincidence. But actually, shouldn't we as Christians believe that that's God acting in practical ways to show us that he is there, that he wants to be part of our world? And the more I thought about that, actually, the worse I felt, because I thought, actually, God trying to show me something and me sort of dismissing it would be a bit like a child trying to give me a birthday present, maybe, and me just sort of dismissing it. And if God's trying to show us signs in our world, and we need to look out for them, we need to acknowledge them and not dismiss them as we tend to, perhaps, as coincidence. So that was the first thing that this passage sort of challenged me about the reality of God. He is a God of coincidence, if you like, but he is the coincidence. The second thing that struck me about this was that Jesus wants to meet us where we are. You know, this story doesn't happen in the temple. It doesn't happen in a place of great significance. He meets them on the beach where they are living out their livelihood. They are fishermen. They're in the place where they work, where they go to generate their livelihood and the way of survival. And it made me think, if it was now then, where would God meet us? Would it be in Costa? Would it be in Marinos over the road? Would it be in our place of work, wherever that might be? You know, I've said before, I don't think we're supposed to compartmentalise our lives. You know, God doesn't intend that he's just for Sunday. We work Monday to Friday, and then we have Saturday for rest, and then on Sunday we come to church and meet him. And I think this passage really underlines that. God has gone to the place where he knows they are perhaps even most at ease, most natural, most likely to be, the place that defines them. And again, you know, I thought that is something that we need to be reminded of. You know, God isn't only to be met in the great buildings of our land, in the cathedrals or in our churches here. He's not only for a specific race or a social group. He's not only for a certain amount of brownie points. He wants to meet us where we are, where we feel at ease. Whatever our life looks like, wherever that might be, he will meet us there. We don't have to go somewhere else. We don't have to put on airs and graces. He met the humble fishermen on the beaches of where they fish, on the shore, and he will do the same for us. He wants to be in our daily life. You know, I was looking for some examples of things sort of to help with this. There was a great example of a man who was on a bench, and he'd come to the end of the line, really, and he hadn't got anywhere to go, so he thought, tonight I'm just going to sleep on this bench. And halfway through the night, he was stirred by a dog and a bird fighting nearby, and he got up and he moved to a bench 2 down away from where he was sleeping. And then that morning, he was woken by a bomb that was underneath the bench he had been sleeping on. Again, a story about a lady whose car had broken down, quite apt for me tonight, those of you that know what happened to me this morning, today on the way, but anyway. And she'd got a long journey to go on with her companion, and they prayed and put their hands on the bonnet, and the car started, and it got them where they needed to go, and it stopped just before they, literally on the road where their destination was. And again, you know, that's God at work. He doesn't need us to go to a cathedral or a church to meet us. He wants to meet us in the situations we face, in the lives that we live, in a daily way. And that may be without us even asking him to. But he wants to meet us where we are. We don't need airs and graces. He's not for a specific group of people. If he was here today, he would be meeting each one of us. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday and Sunday. Thirdly, this is also a passage, as it was called, a meal of healing. And you'll notice in the passage that he says three times, do you love me? And actually, to start off with, he says, Peter, do you love me more than these? And there's a bit of speculation about what does he mean when he says more than these? Does he mean more than these, as in all your nets and your fish and your lovely boat? In other words, more than everything. So that in itself is a challenge, isn't it? Do you love me more than everything you have? Which I think is a challenge to us. But it could mean, do you love me more than these? Meaning, do you love me more than these other disciples love me? Or, do you love me more than these? Meaning, do you love me more than your pride or reputation matters to these people? Are you willing to acknowledge me more, even if it causes you embarrassment, than worrying about what these people think? Any of those is possible. And each of those is challenging. But the last two, particularly about loving me more than the others, or loving me more than your pride and reputation, perhaps are the particularly significant ones here. You will know that Peter will have been smarting from his denial of Jesus. The last sort of probably most memorable story before this of Peter is when he's asked three times whether he knows Jesus, and he denies him three times. And I guess Peter then, like any one of us at this point, would be feeling humiliation, perhaps guilt, sadness, shame, inadequacy, regret. I could go on. And yet, in asking, do you love me, and asking it three times, Jesus is giving him a chance to wipe that denial clean. In each answer, he's giving him a chance to wipe the slate clean. In giving him the breakfast, he's forgiving and mending and healing. And I guess the fact that it was three times would particularly have had an effect on Peter. I think it would have done if it had been me. If I'd been asked it once, I might have thought, oh, I'm getting a chance to make amends. But the three times, the fact it paralleled what happened before, I reckon would probably have really struck to the core of Peter's brokenness. And again, there's a message for us there then, isn't there? There may be times when we feel we've let Jesus down. I'm pretty sure Peter felt like that. It might be that we've denied having a faith. We've said, no, I don't believe in God. Or perhaps we've just cleverly avoided revealing it. I know we talked quite a lot of the church weekend away about when people say, what did you do at the weekend? You tend to say everything else and then think, shall I say church? Oh, no, maybe not. And you don't mention that you've been to church. Is it that we do things that we know are not as God would want us to live? I don't know, we gossip. We put others down. We put ourselves first. Perhaps we do things that we're ashamed of. We gamble or we drink. But the message that is of healing for Peter here is that message for us as well. There's a message here, recommit to me and I will release you from that shame. I will release you from that disappointment. I will release you from that regret and that sadness and that guilt and that humiliation. And I will wipe the slate clean. You know, one of the things I love about the week we've just had is that the exams at school finish. And there's one girl that I've taught this year and she's a really sparky, high-flying girl. But as the years gone on, her face has got more and more serious, more and more pressured and sad. And I saw her at the beginning of this week and I called her over and I said, have you really finished? And she said, yeah, I've just had my last one. And her face was just beaming. And she was the old girl that I knew again from the beginning of the year. And it was as if this weight had just gone from her shoulders. And all I can describe it as sunshine just shone through her eyes, through her smile. She was just carrying with her a lightness of her burden being gone. And that's sort of the picture, I think, that we need to take from here. This is a meal of healing. Jesus wants to enter into our lives and release us afresh from the things that bind us, from the things that we feel might make us unworthy for him. Particularly, you know, in this story, he perhaps looks into our brokenness, into our shame, and he wants to pull us out of this. And I found this really nice, I don't know what you'd call it really, it's not a poem, just a story, I suppose, which I think emphasises this idea of what he was doing for Peter. It's called The Pit. A man fell into a pit and couldn't get himself out. A subjective person came along and said, "I feel for you down there." An objective person walked by and said, "It's logical that someone would fall down there." A Pharisee said, "Only bad people fall into pits." A mathematician said, "Wait while I calculate how deep the pit is." A news reporter came along, "Wait, I want the exclusive story on the pit." A self-pitying person said, "You haven't seen anything until you've seen my pit." A fire and brimstone preacher said, "You deserve your pit." A Christian scientist observed, "The pit is just in your mind." A psychologist noted, "Your mother and father are to blame for you being in that pit." A self-esteem therapist said, "Believe in yourself and you can get out of the pit." An optimist said, "Things could be worse." A pessimist said, "Things will get worse." Jesus, seeing the man, took him by the hand and lifted him out of the pit. And I really liked that when I read it, because I thought, actually, that I think is what's happening here in this meal. And in our world particularly, we have lots of different people, lots of different advice, but actually Jesus is the one that we need to look for to pull us out of our pit. He is the one who will rescue us. And actually all we need to do when he asks us that question, he asks Peter, "Do you love me?" is say what Peter said, "Yes, Lord, I love you." He wants to take us from our brokenness, and even if we don't feel particularly broken, that message of healing is for us. But finally, what's interesting about this, it doesn't stop there. It isn't just a sort of reconciliation, a restoration, a healing. There's actually a call that it requires something. It requires something from Peter. And Peter's told, "Go and feed my sheep." And actually, therefore, our faith, our relationship with God, requires some sort of response. If we know that we have a God who wants to act in our life, it isn't coincidence. He deliberately wants to interact with us. If we believe in a God who we love and who we want to say, "Yes, Lord, we love you and we want you to come and save us and hold your hand out to us," then that must not be a message that we hold on to ourselves. And Jesus here actually gives us a model for discipleship. In a previous talk I did a few weeks ago, you remember that actually I focused quite a lot on how we show God's love in the world. And actually, I talked quite a lot about not overtly talking about God and actually doing the little things like stacking the dishwasher at work and things like that. Here, Jesus is taking us on from that. He starts by doing a practical thing. He gives them advice about the net. He feeds them. He comes alongside them and talks to them. And then the meaning of faith is opened up as a result of that. There's a model for discipleship there. You know, Peter jumps out of the boat and has to be the first to the coastline. And actually, perhaps here we're being told, you know, the mission is not so much about how much time you get to spend with me. It's not so much about who can, you know, get to the line for me first and have the most of me. It's actually about meeting with me, being restored to me, but then going out and sharing me with others. So are we ready to feed the sheep? Can we explain our faith if we had an opportunity? It is God who meets us and acts in our world and wants to restore us is for our world. And our world definitely needs our God if we look around it. And that could be quite scary. You know, we get to that point of meeting with God. We're restored by him. We love him, but that bit of then actually sharing our faith with others can be quite scary. And yet, in this passage, we get a reminder of the sort of faithfulness of God and the certainty of God. He tells the disciples, "Put your net on the other side," and they are successful beyond what they would ever have been. So there's a sign there that if we follow him, things will be okay. He will give us opportunities to talk to people, but he will give us the words. He is with us in those moments. We are not alone fishing on the sea. He is with us as we fish. So I just want to, as I said, leave you tonight with that passage, a familiar passage, but one that I think has several things to take away from it. One, do we believe in the God of reality, the God who actually reaches down into our lives and affects it, or do we dismiss him as coincidence? He's a God who wants to meet us in our daily lives. We don't have to do anything exceptional, go anywhere exceptional to meet him. Our daily lives, day by day, is where he wants to dwell with us. If we love him, he wants to heal and restore us. He wants to reach down into our brokenness, into whatever we may feel that stops us feeling worthy. And if we believe in all of that, and we buy into all of that, then our response should be not to keep that to ourselves, but to go fishing or sheep feeding, whichever analogy you want. And we may need to ask his strength to help that. I'd just really like everyone to stand. And I'm just going to pray. And then if we just stand for a few minutes in the quiet. And just, I'd really like everyone just to sort of dwell in God's presence in whatever way you feel that passage might relate to you. And just ask God, whether it's for more courage in feeding the sheep, in talking to others about him, whether it's for a reassurance of his presence in your life, whether it's that you feel broken or unworthy or guilty in some way and you need that healing that Peter had in this passage. Just stand quietly and I'll pray, and then we're going to sing again.